Hello and welcome to episode 55 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hello again, Matt. Here we are for episode 55. It's as if 54 episodes have gone by in a flash, and here we are right in the moment in this very epitome of what I will call now to record this 55th episode. And now, of course, it's been a bit of a shambolic start to this one, hasn't it? Before we actually got to this point, we've had to mackle up another way of recording this because of the shambles with the podcasting software. Bit of a mare.
Yes, I think that's probably a fair assessment of it. Sorry, Zencaster, incompatibility with browser issues, I think. But anyway, so we're back onto alternative methods. Hopefully, it's going to be all right. How's your week been?
Really, pretty frenetic, actually. Another week where Maine, though I was in London, but and battling with the. I've got to go to India in a couple of weeks' time to see some developers and to do with this particular piece of work I'm doing, and battling with the Indian visa process, which I have to say, I've done one for Russia last year, and I thought that was painful, but actually it was at least trying to help you through it. The Indian one is not helpful. So for example, what you have to do is you have to get all your ducks in a row, obviously produce all the information about your catch religion and all of that sort of thing, and then you put it all, you type it all into a online form, and then it tells you to print the form out and take it somewhere. Okay, so then you have to find out where that is, and it's somewhere far-flung location in southwest London, and so then you have to arrange an appointment. So you go onto the online booking system and you press the button and you arrange an appointment, and then you go, right, okay. And then of course you find that appointment's not the right. Okay, no problem, I'll go and change it, because there's a little thing that says change your appointment time. Fantastic, thank you very much, I'll change it. And then I realized I got it wrong, so I changed it again, so that's fine. So the next day I thought, do you know what, it'll be much easier if I do this later in the day. So I go back in and I tried to change it, and it says you can't change this more than twice, you'll have to book a new appointment. Okay, so the system has two options. It's got rebook and it's got cancel and it's got new appointment. No problem. So I cancel the appointment, but click new appointment. Doesn't work. So I email the help desk and they say, no, you can only rebook it twice. Yep. I want a new appointment. No, you can't. That's it. You have to restart your whole process again. Well, can't you book this manually? No, there's no manual way to book an appointment. So it's those arbitrary numbers. I don't understand why you can only rebook it twice when there's a perfectly acceptable system in place to rebook it. And I don't understand why they wouldn't alert you to the fact that, be careful, Chris, you've only got one more chance at this. No, there's a bear trap for you to fall into. Let me say to you, Indian Visa Processing Department, I hate you. I hate you with all my heart, because now I've got to go through it the whole thing again. Now, and that pains me, because it's bureaucracy and admin, and that's not my thing.
Just to think, in but a few months' time, we could have that situation where you had to do that whenever you want to go to Europe as well.
Well, as long as it stops the swarthy swines coming over our borders, then it's got to be worthwhile, hasn't it?
Oh, boy, yeah. Do you still have to go to India House at the bottom of Kingsway?
No, it's some outsourced visa processing centre, no doubt in a box somewhere in, Hounslow or somewhere. It's somewhere like miles away.
Oh, well, you know, it shows you really want to go there if you have to go through all that pain.
Well, I suppose once you've been there, you're kind of used to be, you know, the whole situation in India will be normal to you. Lack of infrastructure, people gibbering at you in unintelligible dialects. It'll be whatever looks back.
Of course, everything they know about bureaucracy they learnt from us. So yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm getting a kicking from my forebears in the Raj. Yes. Okay. Fair enough. So what about yourself, Matt? How was the week?
Similarly hectic. The one thing that really sticks in my mind is we got a Sainsbury's delivery, and the Sainsbury's delivery came with two free products which have a proud sticker on the top of them saying, this is our gift to you, and it's two cans of alcohol-free Budweiser.
I mean, that's normal Budweiser, isn't it?
Oh, Just can't think of anything worse. But no, it was good. It was long. It was a lot of travel, and I had a cold throughout it. So they're coming out the other end of that now, which is good. And the other thing was that it was announced that my wife's place of employment are going to sell half of themselves off to a private equity company. So that's left everybody feeling extremely, content and, at one with themselves and looking forward to the future. As you can imagine, being acquired by a private equity firm that has a chief executive who's described as a close confidant of President Trump. I mean, just, yeah, awesome.
So that's for you guys. They're good. I mean, they're all heart. It'll be, everybody will be investing in the employees and everything. Nothing can possibly go wrong.
Absolutely. Interesting week. Apart from that, just sort of poodling on. I've had a few more approaches about new bits of work, and I'm now at a point where it's like, might have to wait a few months, which is the famine or feast thing. Yeah, but that's all good.
So, yeah. Oh, and you know what? You know that there might be people out there that could benefit from your glut of work. You know, you find a way to be the answer to people's problems. You know, you could be rich, Matt, for this, right?
Some hope. Well, I mean, it's all relative, isn't it? So count one's blessings. I think that's the thing. Anyway, so what we've got ahead this week, we have got our weekly foray into the internet. There's a particularly corking 3 minutes of video on this week's Yin and Yang. And then the main part of the show today is an interview with Paul Armstrong, who I caught up with last week to chat about disruptive technologies in the future. There you go, nice broad side.
So here we are with another Yin and Yang. I'm slightly disappointed, Matt, that we haven't got a jingle for this yet. We really ought to put together some sort of splendid introductory music to this. Maybe I'll look for some. And this week it's you, and you have two items. Now, should we start? Yeah, let's start with the dark side. Let's hear your yin and what you feel has irked you this week on the internet.
So it almost became Matt Hancock's app, but I've decided that's got enough coverage. If you're not aware of that, just do a search for Matt Hancock's app and weep at the data protection inadequacies.
It really was appalling. It was a fantastic story for that, for anybody with a tendency to mock. it was really teed up perfectly.
Oh boy.
Lots of screenshots of Matt Hancock is not working, and Matt Hancock would like to have access to your photos and things like that.
Yeah, I tweeted something about how I've come to the conclusion that GDPR is something that shouldn't be of any concern to any organisation that's currently compliant with existing data protection legislation. The only problem is that no organisation is currently actually compliant with existing data protection legislation. And if the Minister of Digital can't get it right, heaven help everybody else. That didn't win my award for the yin of the week. What did, though, was a 3-and-a-bit-minute video featuring Satya Nadella, the chief executive of Microsoft, and a chap called Arthur, who's the chief executive of the global advertising and marketing group Publicis, where they talked about AI and collaboration and how they are collaborating on AI to improve collaboration through AI at Publicis, and in 3 minutes did not manage to reveal anything about anything. It was a bravado performance by international mega CEOs basically taking the piss, because what they did, it was like a drunken student bet where they said, can we get a video out there? It would go viral, it would be hilarious. And if we don't talk about anything for 3.5 minutes, do you think we can do it? Because you think we can have nothing of any content value absolutely at all for nearly 4 minutes? And the answer is yes, they did it. They did it well done. I will post the link. It is worth 3 minutes of your time just to be able to find out how to do that.
Well, when I went to the Microsoft Future Decoded mega event Excel this year, and I sat and watched the first sort of 40 minutes, 45 minutes of keynotes and things like that, then actually Satya's having a good influence, because that's pretty much how they went too. I didn't learn a damn thing during them. Fair play.
Yeah, there's something I've said for ages actually now that Microsoft, in terms of its stock price, has turned itself around. In terms of its focus as an organization, has realized that it's not competing in consumer computing really. It's got Windows and that's kind of legacy, but it's not going to get into phones, and it seems to be putting more and more focus into its business application side and its AI and Azure and all that kind of stuff. But Satya Nadella talks in riddles. The man, I've never heard anything that he said that I've been able to immediately go, yeah, that's a succinct, catchy thing. I know that's probably pot calling the kettle black, but there we go. That's my yin of the week.
So what about Yang then? You found something that's brightened your days.
Yeah, this is a complete other end of the spectrum, and it's something I've been using for a year or so now, and for me is the beauty of how it's possible to be able to take some well-created content and to be able to make it available in ways that maybe haven't got the best user interface in the world, and I'll tell you, this thing has not got the best user interface in the world, but to make it consumable in a way that makes it really just very useful. And it's a thing called ifootpath.com. And it's an app and a website for being able to find walks in the countryside. And you can search by a number of criteria and things like, does it include a pub? Which is, if anybody does go walking in the countryside, we'll know it's a fairly important element often of a good walk. And you can select by geography and type of terrain and all those kind of things. And it will come back with suggestions of walks you can do. And we've probably done about half a dozen with the family now. And it's just a really nice piece of really practical, useful thing that addresses a real need. As I say, its user interface could do with a heck of a lot of work, but it shows actually the difference between content and well-created content and useful content, and how much of the internet is just a blather of words for no apparent reason. iFootpath.com is really very good. So if you ever go for a walk, I can thoroughly recommend walks, and you don't want to take Marcus Brown's 90 waypoint madness, iFootpath.com is the place to go.
Well, thank you for that, Matt. That's a splendid little yin and yang there, and it means we can move on to our interview, the thing that everybody's waiting for, so that we shut up and somebody sensible talks for a while. And it's the sensible person this week is a guy called Paul Armstrong, who people who are on our WhatsApp channel will already know, I think, because he's been on there a little bit, and he's a well-known tech pundit and writer for various news organizations on disruptive tech and how organizations look at how to utilize this stuff. And you were talking to him about how to assess technology and how he approaches that with his customers.
Hi, my name's Paul Armstrong. I run Here Forth, an emerging technology advisory. I work with C-suite individuals to help them figure out how to use emerging tech sensibly, I used to say. So that runs a gambit from things like Facebook all the way through to autonomic drones and various things in between. I also write for Forbes and a few other places, which keeps me busy.
So one of the things I've been seeing over the last few years is organizations starting to realize that technology is more important now than just office furniture, but they don't really know how to do anything with it until they've got a problem that they can see a known solution for. So they'll look at a new piece of technology and they'll basically ask the question, what's that going to do for us? What's it for? What's the output? And a lot of the technology that's emerging into consumer space, that maybe not into business yet, there isn't really an answer to them. But organisations really struggle to be able to think about how to be able to make sense of this stuff, to be able to allow them to be able to explore ideas. It sounds like you spend most of your life just exploring new technology. How do you go about it? What do you do?
What do I do? So I think it sounds really trite to say, but you've got to have a system. And I think my system starts with me getting up at 7:30 every morning, which I know for some people is like, why the lion, Paul? You know, but for me, 7:30 is early. And I like to have that sort of at least about an hour, hour and a half start on just me figuring out what's gone on since we've been asleep. Because obviously we're not in the right time zone for things, you know, even though news happens 24/7, still a lot comes out from certain areas. Obviously fueling myself with caffeine. Anyone knows me that I do like a good coffee. And then just starting to, you know, compartmentalize things and figuring out where bits feel and that sort of stuff. But really, if you're looking for like emerging technologies, it is a long list of sites and people that I have curated over the years that I call my North Stars in various areas. So say augmented reality, artificial intelligence, blockchain, you know, those sorts of things. I have specific people that I trust to give me the right guidance or the right knowledge on things. And so I just check that out. So I have a loads of different ways. If you want me to list them, I can. Flipboard's a great one. I curated loads of different feeds on that I look after. Twitter's obviously a great one with Twitter lists, you know, RSS and that sort of stuff. That old chestnut, I use that a lot. Newsletters, you know, very, very powerful these days. A lot of people spend a lot of time on them. So it's a variety of things, really.
And for you, are you making assessment early about, you know, is this going to be the next personal computer or tablet, or is this going to be the next 3D television? Are you making that sort of judgment, or are you just kind of impartially saying, no, these are the things that might be happening?
So I like to be a bit more impartial than that. And I think over the years I've been writing, I've gotten a bit better at seeing sort of like the wood for the trees and all that sort of thing. But for me, I'm not a Gartner, so I don't like put a lot of things on a curve and say that's where we are and that sort of thing, because 9 times out of 10 you'll probably be wrong, or someone will disagree with you, and life's too short to argue sometimes. But I will put a stab in the dark about things and inform myself certain points along the way that I consider important and that other people have told me are important that I agree with. And, you know, obviously I challenge that every so often, probably not as much as I should, but there you go, on, you know, what that means, where it is along different sort of spectrums of consumer use and that sort of stuff. For businesses, that's increasingly hard because they have so many signals coming at them. I think one of the best things that you can do is say no to a lot of things, because if it's not immediately right, it's probably not immediately right for a reason. And in this crazy mixed up jumbled world that we live in, I think it's very important to understand, one, how much resource you have, and two, how much resource you can stretch that resource to, if that makes sense. So for me, I've always tried to be impartial with tech, but I do have my own sort of criteria, if that makes sense.
I guess it's the other factor here now, though, that the market impact of an organization saying they're exploring a sort of technology can be greater than the actual impact of the technology itself. So, you know, everybody these days is talking about how they're looking at AI. You had the thing a few weeks ago where Kodak said they were doing blockchain, and then a couple of days ago saying, oh, it's a bit delayed. And, you know, their share price has gone up and down like some sort of cryptocurrency as a result of those kind of claims. So the part of it is about what they might actually practically be able to get out of these technologies. But there's also a kind of, it's more than PR, but it's that kind of communicating that we are doing things, almost becoming more.
Yeah, we're doing stuff. Yeah, totally. Blockchains, though. Let's be more specific. Bitcoin is an amazing example of how tech works, right? You've got lots of outside forces saying things, doing things, things happening, and they affect in real time how, you could say, the stock market price is opinion as well, right? So if China comes along and says they're all illegal, don't know what you're talking about, you should stop using this stuff, boom, Bitcoin like falls through the floor. And you go, yeah, because that's a few billion people that won't be using that technology, you know, and that sort of thing. So I would say that's how I sort of think about tech as well. it's not a finite line or anything like that, but it is, you have to see it as a sort of almost a balloon with outside forces pressing on it. It has to go somewhere. It doesn't usually disappear unless you push too hard and then it pops. But, you know, obviously oversimplifying that. But yeah, I think that's a great example of what you just described, what I'm seeing out there with some technologies.
You wrote a book called Disruptive Technologies. What for you are the things that signify a technology that is disruptive? And I think it's quite it's a common term. I'm just interested to know what your take on that is.
For me, I obviously read Clay Christian's book, The Innovator's Dilemma, which I recommend everybody read after they've bought my book, obviously. Mine's the sort of like three-paragraph version, then you've got another book to read if you want. It's totally up to you. But it's, for me, the disruption comes down in a couple of ways. And I think, first and foremost, it's always the bottom left-hand corner of the graph, you know, what's happening down there with the people that you can convert quite simply. It's usually a contentious theory, you know, that it got a lot of backlash when it first sort of came out. But really, it's about context, you know, what's going on around and how quickly it happens, right? Because you can't be disruptive if something's really happened over 10 years, you've just been lazy, right? So I think the biggest thing in those sorts of arenas is often people's response rate, timing sort of rate and that sort of stuff, but also the impact that it has. Is it so total, like the totality of the impact, is it so crazy different to what you had before, or has someone just tweaked something, you know, and they maybe like run onto something? So one is disruptive, the first. The other one is definitely not. They've just been a bit innovative, or maybe even they've just changed something. That word innovation is totally misused. We need a new one. But that for me is the other one. So you've got the totality of the impact and the speed at which it happens. And those are the main sort of two things I urge people to take away when it's about disruption.
Christensen's book's like 20 years old or so now, and he was reporting on stuff that had been going on for a decade before that. You do wonder why businesses haven't got their heads around this stuff yet, because it's not new. You know, big significant disruptive technologies have been happening since the spinning jenny.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that obviously Christensen was trying to nail at the end is going like, this stuff's speeding up, right? We got a lot of stuff that we had to build in order for now it to go like a rocket ship. And that's what he's sort of seeing with the likes of Uber and all these new sort of ecosystems that are then causing new spurts of innovation and disruption and that sort of stuff. I think I totally agree with you. You know, if you paid attention and that sort of stuff, you knew stuff was coming because it kind of fit the natural law of how things progress. But then there were others that just literally came out of nowhere and that sort of thing. And the technology we had of yesteryear were things, right? You know, tangible, really big things that, you know, you could either pick up, you had to buy and that sort of thing. Whereas now you could be impacted by something and still not use it. Uber, great example, right? Not really disruptive technology. That's been argued on the internet backwards and forwards. I don't spend my life doing that. But Clay doesn't agree that it's particularly disruptive. They just changed a few things and created a new sort of business model, if that makes sense. But what was quite interesting, I think, is when you get something like the Netflix of the world, which are really pushing at their like edges of the balloon to be like, this should be bigger, we need more, and we're going to go in this direction. And they've got the potential to do that. You know, they've built these layers and infrastructure, and things are now feeding into them that really make a lot of sense. You know, you've got the devices, you don't need to build that area. So now how do we do it? You know, the next thing I think they'll be pushing into is cars.
Yeah, I guess the other thing is that when you touch there, the models by which traditional organisations consume and deploy technology are on that kind of engineering, big investment, big capital, slow lumbering, here's a thing. And that also is, I think, always been predicated on the idea that the thing that is delivered is final, that we build change around the idea of steady state. And again, what I see with clients at the moment is a real challenge where they're not getting their heads around the fact that, you know, you move into cloud technologies and you move into a world where nothing is ever stable, is not quite the right word, steady, that everything continues to change, and that you have to now be in this world where, you know, everything is adapting all the time. And industrialized organizations tend to want to be able to minimize ambiguity, minimize risk, minimize change, everything nice, neatly, you know, like a Ford production line where you know where everything is and everything is following the perfect process and everything is calm. And that's not the chaotic world that we're, I mean, probably never was, but more than ever now, but that's not the chaotic world we find ourselves in.
No, I mean, what you just described there was an axis of control, wasn't it? You know, older people and older businesses tend to like control because that's safe, secure, and they know what's happening, you know, and it's like A plus B equals C. Whereas now that formula can still work, you know, if you put something in that, but there are other forces that work against you for that. So the idea of being, you know, agility, acceptance of change, welcoming of change even, you know, and that sort of stuff. Those are new sort of fresh concepts to a lot of people. Whereas you've got generations that have been born, you know, for a number of years now who are coming up going like, we should have been doing this years ago. Like, what's happening? Can you just get off the pot now so we can do stuff? I see that more and more. You've just got a group of really frustrated younger people who aren't like bang on ready, let's be CEO and that sort of stuff, but they've got a lot to offer and it's being stifled. And I see that as a major problem, specifically in the UK, but obviously I'm sure it happens elsewhere. But yeah, I think we've got a real problem when it comes to that sort of thinking and mentality, because it's still around, you know, and for good reason. You know, safety and security is a great thing, you know, it keeps people going, but there's arguments and, you know, the disruption curve is exactly, you know, the forewarning that should be happening all around the world, really. You know, businesses are not safe, you know, they are not secure. Those things are a right, not a privilege, you know, that sort of thing. You've got to fight for your place.
Within your book, you have a framework, TBD.
Yep, technology, behavior, and data. I came up with it when I lived in LA about 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago, and it was a conversation that I had with a person I didn't know then, but I know him very well now, who was a sort of Hollywood agent, but in the up and coming bit. And we were talking, we were up high on the Hollywood Hills, where I didn't live, I'll add, at a very swanky cocktail party where it was a networking thing. And we didn't know each other and we had a quick chat. He was like, oh, it's really interesting. You can see how it all works down here, can't you? Referring to the LA transport and sort of LA system, as it were. And I was like, yeah. And anyway, long story short, it's in the book. It's not a very thrilling story, but it covered a page. To TBD, we said, look, it's all about technology, behavior, and data. We started talking about the movie system and Hollywood and why technology is eating its lunch and that sort of stuff. And so at its simplest, we came up with three simple pillars of how to make a decision. And that's the first thing about TBD. There is a secondary part of the book called the TBD Plus Compass, which is much more about investment levels and that sort of stuff. Lots of math in that one. So TBD, the simple version, is to get you from A to B, from making no decision to making a decision. So you have three criteria: technology, behavior, and data. And technology is really about, can they do what you're asking them to do, right? So whether it's something to do with Snapchat, Bitcoin, whatever it is, can they literally do the job that you want them to do? Okay. And then the B part, the behavior part, is all about, will they do? So psychologically, technologically, can they do what you're asking them to do, right? Will they then do it? Okay. Is the second one. And then the third one is the data one. And then will enough of them do it to show either an ROI, to make a difference, to get your PR, so whatever your output is. And then each of those get a score of 10, maximum 10, obviously zero is at the end. And so your maximum score is 30. And then what you do is you create a response matrix, which we called a decision matrix. So literally you decide what a 30 means for your business, whether you go, oh God, shut the doors for a day, we're doing this, or whether it's initiate a 6-month feasibility study on it. You've got £10,000. You know, it's got to be as specific as it as possibly can, and it's got to enable people instantly. It cannot be refer back to so and so and ask for permission. You know, that sort of thing. This is a pre-agreed set of rules and regulations that if things hit a certain amount, you have to do something. So it's partly not to just run away with yourselves and just start doing R&D on your own, but also to get a criteria that the business agrees on. And that's the simple version of it. So you get your score out of 30, you look at what you put on your decision matrix, and then you go away and you start doing that stuff and you report back and that sort of thing. So I wanted something that was really simple to remember that worked, because I've seen it work, as something that, you know, can work for big companies, small companies, alike.
I think it's being able to give a different set of frameworks to the traditional, I guess, so many organizations are caught up in investment process thinking. And the challenge with investment process thinking is it starts with what will be the final thing that you deliver and how much benefit will it deliver to us?
Absolutely. What do I get at the end of this without you knowing any of the process in the middle?
Yeah. And that actually, I mean, I've seen on more than one occasion now where organizations claim to be running in an agile manner, but they started with an investment process that is of absolutes, which means that then nothing can fail. And it's lost any chance of being able to be exploratory or iterative or anything, because the framing of the whole thing up front has been in a very, very traditional, long-term, capital investment model.
Yeah, I think the explore word you use there is key. A lot of businesses, you know, let's be honest, it's tough out there, right? You know, a lot of people got a lot of times they think they're worried about layoffs, all of this sort of stuff. PR's breathing down their neck about something. GDPR's coming at them. They've got a million and one things. If you say to someone like, when was the last time you explored? They're like, when was the last time I slept? You know, and so you could say, if you don't give yourself the headspace or the frameworks to do that, you never will, or you'll do it really badly. You'll think you're doing amazing and then you go, oh, we got the same thing that we thought we'd get at the end. That's not really exploration. That's sort of like proving what you thought, right? Exploration is kind of like, I don't know where I'm going. You know, I might have a rough idea, like that thing on the map over there, but how I get there, really different. And that's the key. And that's what I think TBD plus Compass really helps people with, is figuring out that sort of layer of investment, whether it's time, money, resources, to go on a journey, you know, which sounds a bit wishy-washy, but you kind of have to if you are taking this sort of stuff seriously. If you're kind of like, look, I'm riding this ship, but I've only got 5 years left and I'm not really that worried about the heritage of this place, then you've got a bigger problem on your hands. But I think whatever level you are, you can use TBD to really, you know, kickstart your thinking in a number of ways.
Something else that you've established in the last few months is a network and series of events and online resources and a bunch of other things under the brand of The New Normal. Tell me a bit about the thinking behind that.
Sure. So I set up TNN, The New Normal, when I may have had a drink. And I was a bit frustrated to say, look, because I was looking at my inbox and I said, I've got so much good stuff in here. I can't possibly write it all because I have to make rent and journalism isn't the super duper paying machine that I'm sure most people think it is. And I said, I would love it if someone curated all of this and put it in a feed. And if, as I said, if somebody paid me to do it, I would be very happy. That would bring me a lot of happiness. Not an unhappy person, but it would bring me more. And so I started thinking like, right, I'll set up a little Slack feed, done, did that in like 30 seconds, put some stuff on a website, sent it to 10 friends, lean startup, all of that. And I got 5 people back saying, I would definitely sign up for this. You know, if it carries on at this sort of level, that would be great. And I was like, okay, cool. And then somebody said, oh, but wouldn't it be great if you had some sort of original content other than the analysis you put onto things like reports, or curate 5 links about a certain topic and then say why that each of them should challenge something they're thinking about it. And there's lots of other post types and stuff like that. But at its heart, it is a paid Slack channel. So you pay 50 quid a month, roughly. No. Yeah, $50 a month, sorry. And you get access to all of this data. You can obviously network the hell out of all the members and that sort of stuff. And then the original content basically comes from these things called Speak Ups, which we do in partnership with Moo.com, great business card people, plug. And people like Firebox, Nomo, who make luxury bags, they all came on board really early. And I was really pleased that they sort of bought into the idea. And we bring together about 100 people to talk about the future of ... something. And before, you know, it's not just like a deck that they've put out before. It's a really curated look at what is the realistic future, not the 50 years out. It's like the next 2 or 3 years, what's going to happen. And it's not trends or anything like that. It is usually data. It's a landscape view. It's a very honest look. I'm fine with them saying, I don't know, but I know this is going to be important and that sort of stuff. And we've had some amazing speakers, Edsel Wired. We had Bruce Daisley from Twitter. We've just signed, we've just asked and got confirmation that, Kim's got the Radical Candor, New York Times bestseller, is going to come and speak in April. We've got Sej Beswick of Scene Connect, who is just one of the most smartest people I've met when it comes to influencers. She really does get how it works and not use any of the technology that you can to scam people and that sort of stuff. I'm very intrigued by her, so she's doing one. And yeah, there's loads more planned. Like, we've got the Future of the Future, which is really interesting, coming up. We've got one on Brexit, which I think is gonna sell out in 30 seconds with the person we've got. And yeah, loads of others planned. It's just one of those things that all came together, and it's working really well, and I hope has got a lot of legs. It certainly brings a lot of interest for people, I've been told. And yeah, you know, the feed is obviously the focus, but the TNN speak ups are the most visible part of it. So I would urge you, if you want to check out an information source that is unbiased, go to peerforth.com/TNN and check it out. But you can also sign up for all the events, and they're free.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That part of this is about data, but it's also an awful lot of this is about networks and people and relationships. Actually, how do you sense, mate? How do you get to understand what the, you know, what is going to be important to you or not? And the answer to that often is by building a network of people who you can get that from, as much as it is about the perfect data source. Which is, I think there's something about, there's a kind of contradiction, I think, in the tech world that often the tech world doesn't really understand, because it can be a bit unempathetic, a bit unpeople-y, that actually it's not just about the data. In fact, often data isn't that important at all. You can find out way more quickly by having the strength of network.
Yeah, I think a lot of the times it just confirms precincts and that sort of stuff. It's a very blunt tool, and I'm not seeing a lot of data used very smartly. And I hope to change that with the companies that I work with. But I mean, it's a hard slog. You know, people are addicted to data. And I think you can be addicted to data if you do something with it as well. Happy to have you addicted to data if you do something. But the fact is, people are just sitting on piles of data and they're not doing anything. And they're paying for the privilege. It's very bizarre to me, but yeah.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, I was involved with data warehousing stuff in the 1990s, which was, I guess, the first wave of people claiming that there was going to be untold wealth to be driven by exploiting the data that organizations had. And I've seen a few projects that have been able to, you know, stuff with, you know, better consumer, direct consumer marketing through consolidation of customer data across an organization. But a lot of the stuff that was the promise of management information systems and data warehousing in the 90s are exactly the same promises that are being given about big data and AI today. And there are human behavior things that get in the way of that working that I think get overlooked a lot of the time.
I'm very bullish on artificial intelligence. It's obviously a massive game changer, quote unquote, hideous word, very important. And the people I meet and talk to and that sort of stuff are obsessed with it. Because obviously we've all seen the films and we know where we want to get to. We're just not quite sure how or why we should get there. But the ability for people to actually articulate what is machine learning, what is neural networks and that sort of stuff, they just lump it in with AI and it helps no one. I always say, if you can be specific about something, be specific. If you must be general, make sure you tell them that's a general view. You know, it's actually obviously subsets of it. But AI is one of those things. I was at an event yesterday and people were fragrantly misusing it and that sort of stuff, and it wasn't helping anyone. And that's a big bugbear. So I urge people to really just use AI in the most cautious of ways for all parts of that.
So just to finish up, I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but if you were to go into a general business at the moment, and let's say a non-consumer business, so a business services thing or somebody providing services to other businesses, whatever that might be, of the technologies that are around at the moment, what do you think are the things that people should be getting an understanding of? Where should they be putting their cognitive effort in trying to understand these emerging fields?
So I think blockchain is a big one for any, you know, whether you're B2B, B2C, anything, kids' toys or anything, you've got to understand the power that that technology can have. It is a foundational technology. That's the one thing I always try and drill into people. I was like, ignore the thing, that the underlying element is the important part, right? So is that the fact of it is you can build a lot on it. People have obviously gone to the money side very quickly. There's way more on the supply chain, smart contracts if you're legal, all of those sorts of things are way sexy, in my opinion. Obviously, that, you know, if you're a banker, it's not going to be the same. But for businesses and small businesses, I find that they are that's the most important area to sort of just get your head around now so that you can go, okay, yeah, I think right now we should be looking at that. Or in 6 months, let's just see where we are and do that. But put a process in. Obviously, AI we've mentioned already, that's super important, but we're nowhere near close to actually being, you know, the singularity or anything like that. But it is coming, obviously. There are wet work people, as they say, trying to put data in our brains and vice versa. And the other one, I'm still bullish on 3D printing. It's not sexy. It's not out in the homes as people wanted, but it is revolutionizing industries left, right, and center from an industrial point of view. So I would say, you know, if you've got some money, pop it into some 3D printing places because they're making 3D printing is a great example of when a technology was rapidly PR'd and, as I say, sexualized. But then people go, oh, it's very expensive. I can't get to it. And all I've seen is pencil holders, you know. Like, so they wouldn't have seen 3D printed, teeth guards that you've just mentioned, which is highly useful, people could recognize it. But now you're starting to see things like, oh, yeah, that building was built in a day and it can house 8 people. So if you're a refugee, you know, and that sort of stuff, yeah, you've got a new, brand new home with like cement walls and everything. You know, amazing potential that it's got to really, you know, upset a lot of industries. But it's now having to do it quite quietly because of the initial PR burst and that sort of stuff. So, again, can still be disruptive. In fact, the best way to be disruptive is go under the radar and sort of like just keep on going and that sort of stuff. No one's noticing you, and then shank right at the end. So I think 3D printing is going to come back in that sort of way, certainly for the building industry, that's for sure.
So thanks again to Paul for spending some time chatting to me. If you want to have a chat with him, you can find him on the general online channels. But he's also a participant in the WhatsApp group that we've got for WB40. Details of how to join that are on the website. It was an interesting chat. He's got a lot to say. And his book, I've had a go through, and there's some interesting approaches. There's some fairly practical stuff for how to go about sort of doing the sense making going forward. But the new normal, the networking group that he set up in particular, I've been to a few of the events and they've been really good, really interesting stuff, and there's a really diverse group of people there, which is always appealing for me.
Yeah, it's always good to get some feedback from people in different disciplines. There's the Nouns Not Numbers event as well, isn't there, which is similar, but I guess less focused on tech.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Names Not Numbers is really not sector-specific at all. I guess the thing with the new normal, it biases towards the kind of marketing digital agency world, but then there's people who sit around that. And say, the two that I've been to, one, the conversation was about the future of work and with Bruce Daisley from Twitter, and then the other one, there's a chap from Wired talking about the future of money. And both of them really thought-provoking sessions, and I think that it's that thing about how do you go about as an organisation making assessment of what's important to look at or what's not, and some of it can be rigorous and systematic and process, and you know that's partly what Paul has provided within the Disruptive Technologies book, but it's also about the kind of serendipitous finding out about stuff and how you extend your network and you go and talk to people. And I think it's interesting that he's doing both of those in the work that he's doing for clients and helping to help others do that as well.
Yeah, that's it struck a chord with me around how you curate your network that and find people that know about certain subjects. And also, it was some point that you touched on, and it's something that we had a conversation on in previous podcasts around how some organisations, they'll say they work agile, but their budgeting and modeler, for example, is absolutely not agile. So that causes a great deal of stress and strain. It's something that I'm seeing in some different circumstances I'm seeing at the moment, where people want to work agile because they see it as a way to crack on without having all the information that they necessarily would need to start a waterfall piece of work. And that's absolutely right. But also, But people don't realize that when you start this process of Agile, you really, you know, you have to do it in a way that embraces it completely. You can't kind of cherry pick and try and pick the best of everything, because that's like treating Agile as a magic bullet that fixes projects that go wrong, where it just isn't. And if you pick people who know about the particular technologies and the way they're implemented, people who get it, you know what I mean? People who actually get it, rather than just people who understand the pure tech, or people who are just trying to bludgeon through a particular way of thinking about a business, it does make a massive difference.
I think, yeah, and it's the being able to realize there isn't one way. There isn't one way to monitor the future. There isn't one way to deliver projects in an organization. I was chatting last week to somebody who's recently come out of working as a program manager in a big European bank. And she was saying, with kind of disbelief, about how they've decided that they're going to be agile throughout and are restructuring the entire organization to be agile. And she was just this, you know, what is this madness? And that kind of, you know, binary, it has to be agile or waterfall. It has to be, you know, digital or not, or whatever these really simplistic oversimplifications are. That big organizations don't often seem to, let's have it simple. Let's have a simple message that everybody can buy into, because we're so complicated. And let's then make things so simple they become a bit dim.
Yeah, that's the curse of simplicity again, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something I'm afraid we see an awful lot of.
Another action-packed episode, Matt. As if we'd done this before.
Well, yeah. We'll get it right one day. We have another show next week, where I'm hoping, if it all goes to plan, we have another guest who is going to be talking about the world of communications, as in PR and internal comms, and how that's changing as a result of technology and some of the challenges in that world, and somebody who I've worked with in the past, which would be good. And then I think we're going to be probably taking a couple of weeks break as you go on both holiday and then international travel.
Yeah, and I'll give everybody a chance to gather themselves and find either, you know, go and listen to other podcasts with worse content, or you know, just sit quivering with anticipation before our return.
That's yeah. We could probably do some sort of countdown timer on the website and everything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we could, you know, little tidbits of what might happen in the next episode, yeah, just to keep people on the edge of their virtual seats.
I like the countdown, though. I think we should be making the web more like 1998 again.
Yeah, okay. In the meantime, though, put a little under construction sign up, will you, with a guy with a little hard hat and a road sign. That would be good. People would understand then.
Oh, things my children will never understand.
So, as we shudder to the climax of this particular episode, please remember that you can catch us, as always, at WB40Podcast on the Twitters and on the iTunes and all of the usual places for the podcast. Our website, which is WB40Podcast.com, where you can find the link for that Twitter app and links to anything that we've, any useful information that we've imparted today. And, of course, if you have time, it would be fantastic if you would leave us a review on the iTunes.